This is Studio 395, a production of the Department of History at James Madison University and its Historical Research Methods course, History 395. I'm Daniel Shogan, a junior history major. The Freedmen's Bureau was an important fixture in the Reconstruction era South. Although it was only around for about 7 years, it set numerous precedents for the way that newly freed slaves would be treated for many years to come. I'm speaking today with Cassidy Sedonis, history major at James Madison University and author of the paper From Slavery to Freedom.
Hi, Daniel.
So, Cassidy, what exactly was the Freedmen's Bureau?
The Freedmen's Bureau was an institution that was created for kind of contradictory purposes. It was supposed to transition 4 million black people in the South who had been in slavery for hundreds of years before to be an instrument of the American economy. And also to translate them into a state where they are just simply no longer property. That's an extremely complicated endeavor that the Freedmen's Bureau was expected to carry out, but with multiple different interests coming from the top.
And do you believe that they were doomed to fail from the start?
It's a good question. The Freedmen's Bureau was not successful. If the Freedmen's Bureau is able to even simply land half of those 4 million black people in the South, to give them property, to give them 5-10 acres of land, then black people become an integral part of the Northern American industrial economy in a way that benefits them, in a way that they are productive, you know, not productive in like a in the silly sense, but actually from an economic sense. They are a productive part of the economy. They are a section of the economy that is hugely important in maintaining the economic status quo in order to continue to produce clothes and textiles, all these things in these northern industrial centers. If the Bureau is just simply able to land black people, it makes it so they have at least a larger stake in the American economy, and therefore they have more power. They just, because the American economy is a little bit more subject to their whims, even if the Freedmen's Bureau accomplishes half of its land ownership program.
So then part of its mandate was a redistributive land practice.
Yes, it absolutely was. However, its mandate was largely unclear. There were the committee was set up of the committee that before the Bureau was invented. There were three men who kind of weighed out what the Bureau was supposed to do. One of them was a staunch advocate for land redistribution. He said that it kind of going with the Sherman plan of 50 acres and a mule, that he kind of fell in line with that understanding, where it's black people deserve to have the property that they worked for so long to, that they took care of, that they made productive for the American economy. The Bureau was not given any funds originally. It was given $0. It was attached to the Department of Defense, and it was supposed to kind of finagle with local organizations and kind of work with the Department of War at the time to organize, without being a quote-unquote burden on the American taxpayer, a way to transition these black people into non-slavery. However, a lot of those people would have a lot to lose from a landed, powerful black population in the South. So even though their constituents are expecting them to do something about the so-called black problem, as many Democrats advertised it in the North, even though their constituents are expecting them to do something about it, their power hinges on them not doing so. At least doing their job to a minimal capacity was their how they would produce the most power for themselves. And so when you're creating a wealth of what could be considered the first American welfare institution, and you're not dedicated to its success, then obviously that's going to limit its product. It's going to limit its scope.
And would you say that was the most important factor for its failure, and not the racist, war-torn South?
I absolutely think that the Bureau's not operating under a coherent mandate caused it to be far less successful than any Southern racism did. And that is not to say that Southern racism did not play an enormous factor in this entire situation, because many of the officers and the ordinators of the Bureau, the argument was, hey, look, these people in the South, they're not going to put up with this. They're not going to suddenly have, how this is the language that they may have used, they're not going to have these black people forced into humanity on them. They're not going to just be like, oh, these people are human now. That's just not going to work on them, they would argue. And so what's smarter would be a more moderate, a more centrist approach, one might say. And it might be, okay, so we'll make it so that black people are sharecroppers and they don't have to, and you don't really have to pay them, and they're in a property purgatory where they don't really own any land, but they're not slaves and they are integral to the American northern industrial economy, but the northern economy doesn't owe them anything. That's what the Bureau's purpose became, and it's extremely sad that that happened. So, but that wouldn't have happened just as a result of Southern racism. Southern whites, rich and poor, were utterly powerless. They owned the land, but Sherman had completely dispossessed all South Carolina, Georgia, parts of North Carolina, parts of Virginia, completely dispossessed the vast majority of landowners there. And so while these rich planters, they are going to be hugely opposed and they're not going to rent to a lot of these black people, the federal government could absolutely, weaponizing the military on the own American public in this way, this is the height of executive authority. The government could absolutely have expropriated all of the land from these Southern landowners, and poor whites would have absolutely committed massive terrorism, violence, Ku Klux Klan. That would have happened. But the American military a lot of this has to do with Andrew Johnson, who is completely against not just like, it wasn't just in his best interest to have a moderate perspective on things. It was in his best interest to actively oppose the Freedmen's Bureau and vetoed them and did anything they could to reduce their funding and destroy them. And so when you take those things into account, it's really the American federal governments, they opted out of the Freedmen's Bureau's success rather than opting into it.
We've talked a lot about the shortcomings of the Freedmen's Bureau. Let's talk about the areas in which they were most successful, particularly education.
So this is the lasting legacy of the Freedmen's Bureau. It was really the thing that created the Southern public school system, which was really, I mean, a huge, huge forerunner for its things. As underfunded as Southern schools are today and as de facto segregated as a lot of them tend to be, I mean, the Southern public school system really came ahead of the rest of the United States. And that should be hugely attributed to the Bureau. However, the Freedmen's Bureau was not wholly responsible for its success. Black people in the South had been attempting to learn for decades, for centuries. White people intentionally, the landed whites and poor whites also, many of them could not read or write, but most of them had a certain baseline education, even if they were extraordinarily poor, that black people were just simply intentionally barred from. Emancipation kind of started stirring, and the Civil War began as more black people suddenly were able to kind of escape to the Sea Isles, which were off of the coast of Georgia and South Carolina, which were kind of a weird, not exactly, they were strange, I'll just put it that. You can research them on your own. But as black people were able to escape to the north and to the west and to non-slave states, then they immediately started pursuing reading and writing skills. And so when you have 4 million people who are really thirsting for humanity, which has been deprived from them for so long, white people can always tell you, oh, you don't have property. White people can always tell you, oh, you don't have a home. You don't have land. You don't have all these things. You're not a human. You're not a person. You don't have legal rights. You can't vote. Can't really ever tell you can't read if you've learned how to read. They can't really tell you you can't write if you've learned your letters. So that was one of the first priorities of freedmen. And so the Freedmen's Bureau was able to slip into an administrative role for many pockets on the Sea Isles that I've mentioned, and in Louisiana, in areas in the kind of western South, in Missouri, and the areas where kind of populations in New Orleans of black people were beginning to school each other. The Freedmen's Bureau was able to send teachers to these areas. And just to emphasize, how important reading was to the Southern black population in the early 1860s. There's the story that I came across when I was reading. So in 1863 and 4, before the Freedmen's Bureau had actually been established, there was a white New Englander who had not originally, who wasn't employed by the Freedmen's Bureau yet, but who was in on the Sea Islands helping to educate these black children and some black adults who were in these kind of non-official schools off of the coast of South Carolina and Georgia. She witnessed a funeral for an older black man who had died for reasons I did not know, but she recorded and wrote in a correspondence to somebody in the American Missionaries Association, of which she was a part of, and wrote how the black children stood in a choir above this open grave, and they sung the ABCs. There's not really any other story that you need to just describe how powerful and how taken for granted being able to read and write is. It's religious. It's to a lot of these people.
What a truly moving story. Can you go into more detail about how capital and class struggle interacted with these newly freed slaves?
Really, what you have is a struggle between the northern industrial bourgeois and the southern black proletariat. Fundamentally, that's what it is. Even though the northern industrial bourgeois, in a lot of ways, because of taxes, other things, because of their stake in the federal government, is responsible for this new agricultural proletariat, the northern industrial bourgeois' intentions and its success is entirely dependent on being able to mobilize this black agricultural force, because the South was 100% the producer of everything that the North, all the resources, the raw materials that the North needed to be able to produce in order to distribute to the American trade system, the international trade system. So when that was completely destroyed by the Civil War, they had to forge a new infrastructure. And it just could not exist without black workers who worked for virtually nothing. And so even though it was the federal government's proper interest, its moral interest, the right thing to do would have been to provide an economic foundation, to provide political rights and legal protections for these 4 million black people, the more utilitarian option, the more economically viable option, was sharecropping, was to use the Freedmen's Bureau to force black people into improper contracts, to make them serfs in a lot of ways to this new agricultural order that the federal government would reinstall these white planters who had essentially started the Civil War, who had funded the Confederate Army. The United States reinstalled them and allowed them to begin to rebuild their wealth, and they did that at the cost of the morality. They did not allow the Freedmen's Bureau, or they didn't trust the Freedmen's Bureau. They weren't dedicated to the Freedmen's Bureau in a way that would have allowed it to create a powerful black agricultural proletariat.
So what it really comes to is that the North was unwilling and or unable, due to their economic concerns, to redistribute the wealth in a way that would positively affect the lives of the newly freed slaves.
There is no 5-year span in American history that more possibly could have fundamentally changed the distribution of wealth in American history than these 5 years, where the industrial, you use the word unable, I would never use that. The northern industrial centers operating through people in Congress, these constituents where, because of the Civil War, because of military contractors, the northern economy is stronger than it has ever been, even though the South has been totally ravaged. The North is still producing. They're producing weapons, they're producing transportation, they're building structures, but it's still producing. However, that cannot continue without forging this new agricultural order. The choice is, do we create an agricultural order that is dependent on multiple or millions of individual farmers who work as a kind of agricultural productive web that then trades with us, that sends resources forward, and we pay fairly and equally down to them? Or do we kind of make a slavery light and we take the 4 million people, and we make them sharecroppers, and we get the same product, but we don't have to pay them. We continue to pay the southern planters what we did in the past. It's one's the cheap option, one's the expensive option, one's the right option, one's the wrong option. The cheap wrong option was the one that we chose.
Do you like cap? We see this happening a lot with capital. It's so much more profitable, and so much just it's seen in such a better light to just take the easy and cheap way.
Well, we should use our word, which is efficient. The decision by the northern politicians, with the support of the northern industrial gurus, to further handicap the black population was an extraordinarily efficient entrepreneurial decision.
Yeah. And efficiency at this point is what led to the black codes and Jim Crow that
absolutely.
We see maintaining this proletariat-like, slave-like narrative throughout a lot of the 20th century.
Absolutely. The Freedmen's Bureau, what I found in my research is that the Freedmen's Bureau, if you're going to call it anything, I don't think it's appropriate to understand it as a extremely incompetent organization or a malicious organization. To me, it's a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a time where the most racist, the most malicious people in the South had absolutely no power. And the federal government opted to squander that opportunity and in favor of making sure that they maintained their wealth, making sure that the American economy functioned in a way that it was designated to work for the previous 100 years. It would have been enormous turnover to completely subvert how the Southern economy worked, to have landed black people, a massive landed black population, each individually responsible for contributing and for selling to these northern industrial centers, where they would have absolutely gained massive amounts of wealth.
Yeah.
If the North were to do that, it would completely subvert years and years and years of economic development. However, what it would have done would have been a massive economic stimulus for the United States. It would have been you had 4 million producers in the South,
mm-hmm.
who their entire well-being and they have absolutely a motivation to produce, because it even further cements their humanity. It's making up for lost time. And so when the United States opts to not exactly atone for its sins originally, and rather kind of adjust its sins in a way that it's reducing them. You're no longer in a state of slavery, but you're not out of a state of servitude. You're just in service to the American economy, as you always were, but in a way that you're sharecropping now. You're not. You have the idea that you are gaining some compensation.
Thank you for listening to Studio 395. More interviews on a wide range of historical topics and subscriptions to our podcast are available on our show page at sites.lib.jmu.edu/studio395. To learn about the history major at James Madison University, please visit www.jmu.edu/history.
London Tide, Newcastle upon Tide. I was 29, the shepherd and his wine. This wasn't my plan. He says I'm too angsty for a grown.